Clerk, please call the next case.
124-2555 WC Antonio D. Alessio by Zibi Badaras versus the Illinois Workers' Compensation Commission et al. Walsh Construction Co. et al. Appellant by Peter Carlson.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Carlson, before we begin your argument, it's my understanding that you did not acquire the court background for your video. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't see it. Did we do something now?
On here? No.
No. I don't see that I have a judge. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, we have procedures for having a courtroom background, and we have a very open way to contact our court and to acquire that background. So it doesn't seem like it's a technical problem on your end or our end, but it's a question of following the procedure. And that's given in the notice for oral arguments. It's well spelled out. And so I would point this out to you. That's not a technical glitch, but it's a procedural failure to follow our procedures. And so from that, it's the way it looks at right now. So for future arguments before this court, those procedures need to be followed.
My apologies, Your Honor, for my oversight on this. If I could correct it right now, I certainly would.
Right.
But if there's a way, I will do it right now.
Well, it's too late now, because in our procedures, we say, get the background. If you have difficulty with the background, notice our clerk, and the clerk will work with you on getting that background. But we're not going to take up court time at now for to do what could have been done earlier. Okay.
Again, my apologies.
Okay, so appreciate that. Thank you. And you may proceed to your argument now, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please this appellate court, honorable justices, counsel, I represent Walsh Construction in this appeal of the circuit court decision and the Illinois workers' compensation decision in this case. The first issue I would like to argue here is the wage differential award in this case. It is our contention that the commission and circuit court decision did not follow Illinois law with respect to proving up a wage differential award. What I cited to in my brief, and I'm arguing here today for legal precedent for that position, is the Crittenden versus Illinois Workers' Compensation Commission decision of the Illinois Appellate Court First District, February 24th, 2017, which was a case of first impression with respect to suitable employment in terms of a wage differential award. And I'm reading directly from that decision where the court stated, we hold that in order to calculate a wage differential award, the commission must identify, based on evidence in the record, an occupation that claimant is able and qualified to perform and apply the average wage for that occupation to the wage differential calculation. In this case, there is no, strike that. In this particular case, at the time of hearing, the claimant, Mr. D'Alessio, was not working. And the Illinois Workers' Compensation Commission utilized a job as a groundskeeper for the suitable employment decision. However, when the claimant is not working at the time of the hearing and calculation, the commission must rely on functional and vocational expert evidence. In this particular case, there was no vocational expert evidence, no labor market survey, no vocational rehabilitation specialist who opined with respect to the average wage for the groundskeeper job position. There is a vocational expert in the case, Ms. Mueller. However, she was never notified of the groundskeeper job that the commission found was suitable employment. In particular, a couple points on that. Number one, the groundskeeper job involved a position that was 50 pounds across the board and was above the FCE findings in this case that the commission also relied upon. Additionally, Mr. D'Alessio notified Ms. Mueller during his interview with her that he could not even take care of his own property, and the groundskeeper job literally involved taking care of a high school property. And so Ms. Mueller was never aware of the groundskeeper job, did not provide any opinions on what the average earnings are of the groundskeeper job, which the commission relied upon for its suitable employment. And therefore, this is a question of law, de novo. There's no evidence in the record sufficient to support the wage differential award. And Walsh Construction cites this case law and argument with respect to the suitable employment and lack thereof in terms of average earnings.
Counsel, as long as you're at that point, then I noticed that in Crittenden, the court said that the arbitrator could have selected $11 an hour based on plaintiffs or the claimants, excuse me, previous job at Target. And so why here was the commission wrong to affirm and adopt the arbitrator's use of the $800 a week from his groundskeeper job? That's a wage he, excuse me, that's a wage he actually made.
At the time of the hearing, the claimant, Mr. D'Alessio, was not working the job as a groundskeeper. He was looking for jobs as a groundskeeper.
Well, he got laid off and the job was eliminated.
Correct.
So you're right about that. But I guess my point is, why was the commission wrong to do that?
The commission was wrong because there's no evidence from a vocational expert that
But your point about Crittenden is that if he's not working, then you've got to have a vocational expert. But that case in and of itself says we could have, or the arbitrator could have used the previous job to get a wage for the worker in that case.
But if I could respond, in that case, there was a vocational opinion for that lower wage. In this particular case, there is no vocational opinion from Ms. Mueller as the groundskeeper job. She never knew about it. She has no idea about it, to my knowledge.
Well, she had no idea because he found that job after he was evaluated by her. Isn't that right?
That is correct.
Thank you, counsel.
Yes. And there's no opinion from her as to what the average earnings are in the groundskeeper job position. With respect to the groundskeeper job as well, there was testimony in the case from Mr. Garcia that the earnings were, you know, not only $20 an hour when he worked there, but could go up. And Ms. Mueller was never given the opportunity to put into the record any evidence regarding what the average earnings are for that position. I would also, one additional point on that, Your Honor, is in reading the Crittenden decision, in several places, it does refer to current earnings. It does say on page five, if the claimant is not working at the time of calculation, the commission must rely on functional vocational expert. It also refers to current average weekly wage if you're going to use the existing job. And he wasn't currently making any wage at the time of the hearing in this case. And there was certainly never any evidence as to average. But I appreciate your point, Your Honor. The next part of the argument that we're making is based on no loss of occupation. And with respect to no loss of occupation, our argument is that, again, we believe the standard is manifest weight of the evidence in terms of did he actually lose his occupation. And with that, I would argue that Mr. DeAlessio did return to his job as a cement finisher. He was employed by another company that was disinterested in the case, Mr. Lampignato, who testified in the case, and he performed his job duties. Mr. Lampignato testified as to what those job duties were, and then he asked him to come back the next day. Mr. DeAlessio refused and proceeded to get an FCE. When the FCE came back, the findings in the FCE were all within what he did while working for Mr. Lampignano. And I know counsel has argued in this case that his client claimed that he could not pound the stakes for the cement finishing job. However, there is no restriction in anywhere in the medical records from either Dr. Chudik or from the FCE that says he can't pound the stakes. The FCE supports that he is able to do the job that he was in fact doing, and then chose not to continue when offered by Mr. Lampignano. Additionally, he then proceeded to take a job as a groundskeeper, which had a 50-pound limit, which was above the level of the FCE. And so here again, it's a situation where the evidence supports the argument that Mr. DeAlessio is physically capable of doing what he was actually doing. There's no evidence from a medical provider that says he can't pound the stakes. I realize he testified that it hurt when it did that. However, on a manifest way to the evidence standard, having done it with the evidence from Mr. Lampignano, a third party, and then proceeding to then do a heavier job later, we believe Walsh's position is that the manifest weight of the evidence is that he did not lose his occupation. I would also point out with respect to the FCE, it was done 9 months after the surgery, and both doctors in the case, Dr. Arabindi and Dr. Chudik, both testified that it could take up to a year in order to fully recover from that surgery. And so, you know, at the year point is right when he was about to start with the groundskeeper job. So I would ask that the court consider that. With respect to causal connection, we're relying on our brief in this. We realize this is a manifest way to the evidence standard. You know, Dr. Arabindi did testify that he thought the injection was in the wrong spot of the shoulder for the labral pathology. And based on the surveillance that he observed, he thought that Mr. DeAlessio should have made an effort to return to cement finishing work at that time, which did not happen. And then the final argument I'm making at this time is with respect to the billing issue. I realize that the commission did order that the medical treatment and the surgery, you know, was reasonable and necessary. However, they never addressed the issue with respect to the billing. You know, Dr. Arabindi had several opinions in the case regarding the medical billing. Dr. Chudik, the treating surgeon, said he never even looked at the bills. And so just awarding the bills per the fee schedule doesn't address the issue in terms of the bills themselves. The commission never addressed that. So we feel that this is a de novo issue where the commission should have to make a decision with respect to the billing as raised by in our brief and by Dr. Arabindi's opinions in this case.
Thank you. You know, regarding that, counsel, the arbitrator said that the Dr. Arabindi was unpersuasive on causation, and she extends that finding to his opinion on reasonableness and necessity of the surgery. It sounds to me like she's speaking to the billing issues that he raised in his testimony. And then the commission affirms and adopts. So how do you how would you respond to that? You
Yeah,
claim they
so
never addressed it, but if it's in there and they affirm and adopt, isn't that sufficient?
I would argue no, because it is petitioner's burden to prove that every element of the case. Dr. Chudik's testimony is that he never even looked at the bills. That's what he testified at his deposition. And while I appreciate Your Honor's point with respect to the commission found Dr. Chudik more persuasive than Dr. Arabindi, Dr. Arabindi's opinion is still there, and Dr. Chudik never looked at the bills. He never looked at them. So petitioner did not prove their case, and the commission never decided it. And so we're asking that the commission at least review that and provide a decision. Because otherwise, the issue with respect to billing it remains undecided.
Well, as I say, it was brought up at the hearing. It looks to me like the arbitrator responded to it. And the commission affirmed it and adopted. So it seems to me like it was addressed.
I didn't see anything in the decision that addressed billing at all. All they said was that the treatment was reasonable and necessary and pay it per the fee schedule, but they didn't address any of the billing issues.
And the billing issues were allegedly that Dr. Chudik billed for some procedures that were unnecessary. That's how I understood it.
There's an element of that to it. It gets pretty technical. It gets pretty technical in terms of the number of surgical procedures on the operative report. But what it comes down to is more of a billing issue than a reasonableness issue. And it wasn't addressed in terms of the commission's decision on whether that billing is appropriate, even with the procedure that they found reasonable. And as a practitioner, this issue comes up quite a bit. And Walsh and myself, we'd like the commission to be deciding these sorts of issues so there's clarity going forward on medical billing. And this is an example of that.
So what exactly is the issue with the billing that you're raised or raising here?
So there are several, the operative report itself had seven CPT codes for different procedures. Dr. Arabindi specifically went through the operative report in terms of billing and said several of these procedures are essentially the same procedure. And it should be bundled together and not billed the way it was. And so that was the issue with respect to the billing, is that not that the surgery it's I of course Dr. Arabindi disagreed with the surgery, but I'm realizing that the commission said, okay, the surgery was reasonable and necessary, but how the bills get processed through the fee schedule is a separate issue. And Dr. Arabindi reviewed the bills and said that the billing was not appropriate in terms of several of the procedures and the CPT codes being presented and should have been, one charge as opposed to two, or bundled together as one, or not even a procedure that was actually done in terms of, I think one of them was a CPT code for going through the capsule, which is really just going through that tissue to get to the other part of the rotator cuff. And so it's technical. And I appreciate that. However, it is significant in terms of billing charges, and the commission not deciding it leaves that uncertainty out there, not just on this case, but it could be on many cases. And I think it's important that the bar have some direction in these sorts of situations where there's a billing dispute, where the commission rules on it instead of just saying per the fee schedule. We don't really then have a decision. And here I go back to this. Dr. Chudik said at his deposition, He never even reviewed the bills. The bills were just put in. Petitioner didn't offer any evidence to refute what Dr. Arabindi said on the actual billing dispute, just that there was a reasonable charge and the fee schedule, pay it.
So what are and I'll ask opposing counsel the same question. What are you proposing as a policy or a procedure?
What I'm proposing, Your Honor, is that this issue be remanded back to the commission to make a decision with respect to whether Dr. Arabindi is right or not on the billing. At least we would have a decision. And that's why I'm suggesting it's de novo, because it's not addressed at all. There needs to be a decision.
So you're recommending or proposing, again, opposing counsel can respond to it, of course, that there be a remand for the addressing of that issue, a finding on that issue,
Yes.
a separate finding on that issue.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions from the court? No? Okay. You'll have time in reply.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Is it... Counsel Bednarz, am I correct?
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay, you may respond.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Zibi Bednarz. I represent Mr. Delisio, the appellee in this case, counsel. I would like to focus my argument on what I think the single most important issue in this case is and the largest hurdle that the appellant has not cleared, and that is simply the manifest weight of the evidence. There are three issues in this case that the appellant raises. Number one, the wage differential award. Number two, causal connection. And then number three, whether the surgery bill was appropriate. I would submit to your honors that each and every one of these issues is a manifest weight issue. It is a question of fact. And unfortunately for the appellant, the commission found each of these issues in Mr. Delisio's favor. There's plenty of evidence in the record to support these findings, and none of them were against the manifest weight of the evidence. Turning first to the wage differential, there are two elements of a wage differential claim pursuant to Albrecht versus Industrial Commission. Number one, whether there has been an incapacity that prevented the claimant from returning to his prior occupation. And number two, whether there's been a resulting impairment of his earning capacity. As to that first element, Mr. Delisio's right shoulder injury resulted in permanent restrictions. Both Dr. Chudik and Ms. Mueller, the vocational counselor, testified that those restrictions did remove him from his prior occupation. He attempted to return to work in that same role. He worked for two different contractors on two different days. He credibly testified that he just could not do it. Whether Mr. Lampagnano's version of that event was to be believed, or whether Mr. DiAlessio's version of those events were to be believed, are respectfully irrelevant to us now because those are questions of fact. And the reality is that the commission found that Mr. DiAlessio was more credible than Mr. Lampagnano on how that return to work went. Once it was established that Mr. DiAlessio was removed from his prior occupation as a cement finisher, the next element, whether there was an impairment of his earning capacity, was, I think, inevitable. He, according to Ms. Mueller, she testified that he had a singular work history. He had no high school diploma. He had no GED. He had done nothing else besides being a cement finisher for his entire life. And there is no evidence to suggest that he could earn anywhere close to the almost $50 an hour that a union cement finisher was making or would have been making at the time of the trial. Counsel suggests that Ms. Mueller didn't provide any opinion on his ability to earn income, and cites the Crittenden case to lend support to that. And Justice Mullen, you pointed correctly out that that case does indicate, well, you can use these prior wages as evidence. And counsel's response to that was, well, Ms. Mueller didn't actually know about that job, and she didn't provide an opinion as to his earning capacity, and therefore the court can't rely on that. And if we were to follow that logic, Ms. Mueller did actually provide an opinion as to his current earning capacity at that time. She opined that he could earn between $11.80 per hour and $19 an hour, which is actually less than what he was earning in that landscaping job. So if now the court cannot use the $20 an hour job, what alternative is there? Is it 19? Should his current earning capacity be even less? That's not what we're asking for, but I think that's where counsel's logic would lead us. At any rate, the commission had plenty of evidence to support the finding that his current earning capacity was $20 an hour. Of course, he had the job. He worked it for weeks until he had to go off for an unrelated health condition. And then when he tried to come back, the job wasn't there anymore because they lost the contract. The idea that the petitioner, that Mr. DeLisio would be able to return to work as a cement finisher because he was able to do that landscaping job also doesn't hold water. Counsel suggests that the job required lifting 50 pounds, but if we examine the testimony of Trevor Garcia, Mr. DeLisio's direct supervisor, Mr. Garcia admitted several things that I think are important. Number one, he admitted that the job description was up to 50 pounds. And when asked about how frequently he would actually have to do that, he admitted that it was very rare. He also admitted that skilled maintenance role that paid better did pay better, but he also indicated that Mr. DeLisio was not qualified for that work. So yes, perhaps he would have gotten some raises over time had he been able to keep that job. But the reality of the evidence that was submitted at trial, the manifest weight of the evidence, one might say, is that the maximum earning capacity that was determined or supported by the record is $20 an hour or $800 a week. Mr. DeLisio never waived his right to an award for a wage differential under 8D1, and pursuant to the Gallianetti case, the commission was therefore compelled, once he established those two elements, that he was removed from his prior occupation and the reduction in his earning capacity, the commission was compelled to find that he should be awarded a wage differential, which is, of course, what they did. Moving on to the second issue of causation, this is also manifest weight of the evidence, as counsel admitted. There's plenty of evidence to support this finding. Mr. DeLisio had no prior complaints in the right shoulder. There's no evidence of that. He had an undisputed work accident with a mechanism of injury that is consistent with a shoulder injury. He landed on his outstretched arm. During the surgery, Dr. Chudik visualized both the rotator cuff tear and a labral tear. He took some photographs. Dr. Arabindi agreed that one of those photographs showed a labral tear. Even ignoring the causation opinions in the record from Dr. Chudik's testimony, the commission could have simply found a causal connection based on the International Harvester Standard. He had a prior condition of good health, he had the accident, and then he had a subsequent disabling condition. But there is more evidence than that to support a causal connection finding. The arbitrator and the commission found Dr. Chudik more credible than Dr. Arabindi. And frankly, I'm not very surprised by that. I think the easiest way to evaluate why Dr. Arabindi was not persuasive is to think about the chronology of how his opinion evolved over time. When he first examined Mr. DeLisio, he had occasion to review that September 30th, 2019 MRIs from just a couple of weeks after the accident. The radiologist who read that MRI didn't seem to think much about it. It was largely unremarkable. But when Dr. Arabindi looked at the MRI and also importantly performed his physical exam, his initial conclusion was that there was labral pathology. He thought there might be a tear here. In fact, he said, try to get an injection, and if that doesn't help you, you might need a surgery. Mr. DeLisio gets the injection. It doesn't help him. But before the appellant authorizes that surgery, they get surveillance and they get another opinion from Dr. Arabindi. Dr. Arabindi reviews that surveillance, and during his testimony, he admitted that the only thing that changed his opinion from probable labral pathology and maybe a surgery to full duty, no problems at all, was the fact that he visualized on that surveillance video that Mr. DeLisio was lifting objects over his head. The problem with Dr. Arabindi's opinion is that when I asked him to actually watch that video during his deposition, a video that I'm sure your honors have all watched, it's only a few minutes and it's in the record, there is no lifting anything overhead. The only thing that that Mr. DeLisio does overhead at all is talking with his hands like this. So the idea that Dr. Arabindi, when he first examines him and looks at that MRI, thinks it's a labral tear, and then the only thing that changes is seeing him lift objects overhead that he didn't actually lift, is not exactly the hallmark of a credible opinion, in my opinion. But again, it doesn't really matter what I think or what any of us think about who's more persuasive, Dr. Arabindi or Dr. Chettick, because the standard at this point is manifest weight of the evidence. And as long as there is sufficient evidence, which there's ample in this case, to support Dr. Chettick's conclusion, the lower court's decision should not be disturbed. Now, with the benefit of hindsight, we now know that Dr. Chettick visualized both a rotator cuff tear and a labral tear during the surgery. Both doctors turned out to be right. Both types of pathology were there. And with the benefit of hindsight, we know that those injuries were there, in fact, because both doctors admitted that intraoperative visualization is a better measure of internal pathology than diagnostic MRI or provocative testing on exam. So for those reasons, there is plenty of evidence to support the commission's finding on causal connection, and that the finding should not be reversed on appeal either. Lastly, turning to the surgery bill, I understand that counsel believes that the bill was coded incorrectly. I understand that he thinks it was probably too much money, but the problem that he has, again, is manifest weight of the evidence. The commission did find that the bill was reasonable, necessary, and causally related. The bill went into evidence without objection. The only shred of evidence that counsel relies on to find that this commission's finding that it was reasonable, necessary, and related and appropriate was against the manifest weight of the evidence is the testimony of Dr. Arabindi. Now, the problem with that is Dr. Arabindi, by his own admission, is not a medical bill coder. He's never done that in his life. He testified, quote, he does not, quote, get involved in the billing in his office. The only evidence he offers is a vague suggestion that perhaps these bills were wrong. There's no alternative bills that should have been. There's no alternative CPT codes in the record that should have been submitted that would have been accurate. If counsel's asking for this case to be remanded back to the commission for determinations on what? There's no evidence to evaluate. There's only a vague suggestion that these bills were wrong. There's nothing else to do unless counsel wants to submit additional evidence, which I don't think is permitted. There's nothing more the commission can do besides what was done. The fact that the appellant failed to meet its burden of establishing what an alternative bill should have or could have been is not this court's issue at this point. At this point, the question is, was the commission's decision that this bill was reasonable, necessary, and causally related against the manifest weight of the evidence? And as was found, as we discussed earlier with causal connection, Dr. Arabindi was less credible than Dr. Chettick, and the commission correctly found it. Counsel indicated that Dr. Chettick testified he did not even look at the bill and that there was no response as to why these bills were coded in this way, about whether this should be one procedure or two procedures. That's actually inaccurate. Counsel did cross-examine Dr. Chettick about the bill, and Dr. Chettick did explain why these are two different procedures. So the notion that there is zero evidence of that in the record is just not accurate, because Dr. Chettick's testimony is, of course, in the record. Like with the wage differential and with causal connection, I think there is plenty of evidence to support the commission's finding as to the surgery bill. And so Mr. DeLisio and myself, we would submit and we would request that that this court affirm the commission's decisions as to the wage differential award, as to causal connection, and as to the reasonableness and appropriateness of this bill for the surgery.
Well, back to the last issue that we had a conversation with opposing counsel on. I know that your position is that the record is inadequate for a remand in the sense of evidence that was presented before the arbitrator, then the commission, right? And fair, I think, description.
Sure.
But that there is an issue among the bar not getting a decision regarding from the commission on this general area of concern. Do you share that?
I mean, I'm sure there is a issue like that, but the question that is more of a broader question of the practice at large. I don't think it's a question in this particular case. If a respondent or a petitioner has some kind of dispute as to a bill, then it is on them to establish sufficient evidence to explain
Yeah,
why or
but I
how the bill
where
was
I'm
affected.
going is not particularly this case, but to the procedure. Is there a remedy for that? That you get a decision from the commission, evidence that reasonably you think presents the issue for you, but it's not being addressed by the commission, and you want the commission to actually give a specific finding on. Isn't there a procedure? Isn't there a procedure for asking after a commission comes or after the commission decision comes to you as a practitioner that you may petition the commission for specific findings?
Yes, of course. If there's a specific issue that we ask to be addressed and the commission doesn't address it, then the case should be remanded. I just don't think that's what happened in this
Well,
case.
it's not a remand. No. I'm talking about a procedure. You get a commission decision. Isn't there, my recollection is there's some procedure where you can actually go to the commission and ask for a specific finding? Or is that from arbitration to commission?
There is, I mean, there's a couple of options. I think there is, you can file a 19, I think F for a clerical error,
Yes,
if there was
clerical.
some kind of computational error. You could, I think what's called certifying a question to the commission, on one specific issue. I'm not sure that happens after a commission makes a decision or after a case is tried. I believe, and I may be wrong on this, but I believe that procedurally that is to be done before even the case goes to arbitration.
Okay, well, I'm just going from recollection and practices. Okay.
I am also
It's
going from
rarely
recollection and
seemingly
practice.
used. Whatever that procedure in the past was rarely used.
I have never done it myself, Your Honor. I have
Yeah,
heard
that's rare.
about
Yeah.
it, but.
But I might research that. Okay. Thank you. Any questions from the court?
Was the bill admitted without objection?
Yes, Your Honor.
Hearing no further questions, Mr. Carlson, you may reply.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the bill, I believe we did not object to the foundation of the bill going into evidence, but we did not agree with the substance of the bill. In terms of whether the charges were appropriate, nor that the surgery was reasonable, necessary. And we did raise, my client raised, respondent raised at the time of trial, this dispute regarding the medical bill above and beyond the issue of whether the surgery itself was reasonable. And the commission did not address it in the decision other than to say it was a reasonable surgery and pay it per the fee schedule. None of the other information in terms of what we were seeking a decision on was addressed there. And so in this particular case, it's not about manifest weight or de novo. It's about a decision at all in the first place. And that's why I would say it is de novo. It's not manifest weight. They did not address it at all. And getting back to Justice Holdridge's question regarding, some questions in the bar. Sometimes issues do come up with the fee schedule calculation that not all the parties are on the same side. And in the context of a case like this, where you have a surgical charge that can come up, and this is one of the ways that parties can address disputes like this before the commission and get a decision. So respondent is requesting that the commission at least address it and issue a ruling on it. With respect to, I do want to go back to the Crittenden case very briefly. Walsh is relying on the language in the actual decision that states that if a claimant is able to earn some suitable employment or business after the accident and calculating the amount, the claimant must prove his actual earnings for the substantial period after he returns to work, and the commission may apply his then current average weekly wage to the calculation. And then it goes on to say in the decision, however, as the case at bar here, if the claimant is not working at the time of the calculation, the commission must rely on functional and vocational expert evidence. Justice Mullen pointed out the footnote there in the decision. However, I would argue that in the Crittenden case, vocational counselor Blumenthal knew about the job, the $11 job at Target, and provided opinions on that. In this particular case, there's no opinion at all from Counselor Mueller regarding the job as a groundskeeper. There's nothing at all. And I would further add, with respect to how do you prove up a average earnings of a groundskeeper, where somebody, in this particular case, petitioner was not even doing the job at the time and was looking for work in order to provide a solid basis for an 8D1 wage differential. Walsh is submitting that under Crittenden, that there should be vocational evidence from a vocational expert that says, you know, the average earnings in this position as a groundskeeper is needed in order to support the calculation. And I believe the issue with the $11 job is in somewhat conflict with the decision there, but also different because vocational counselor Blumenthal was aware of it and did offer opinions generally regarding that. That didn't happen here. And so Walsh believes that the case should be remanded on that issue for a determination by the commission on the issue of what's the average earnings of a groundskeeper. It was not addressed by Councilor Mueller, and Mr. D'Alessio was not doing the job at the time of the hearing, and he, in fact, was looking for jobs as a groundskeeper at the time. That's my rebuttal.
Questions from the court or counsel? No.
To both counsel, appreciate your briefs, but I did not see in the appendix copies of the commission's ruling, the arbitrator's ruling. There was a copy of the trial court's ruling, and a table of contents is required. I just wanted to point that out. Thank you, counsel.
The commission decision is not in the record. Oh, it's not in the appendix.
Not in the appendix. Yeah, it's in the record, though.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah,
but but it's important. There's a reason for an appendix. It assists. Right. So, and it is required. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel, both for your arguments in this matter this morning. It will be taken under advisement, and a written disposition shall issue.